Bill Carter has been writing about television for three decades or so. For the last 16 or 17 years, he's been writing about TV for the New York Times. You may also know what is probably his best-known work, a book he wrote called The Late Shift in the early 90s, about the battle between Jay Leno and David Letterman for Johnny Carson's desk at The Tonight Show. He's got a brand new book just coming out now called Desperate Networks. And I'm happy to welcome Bill Carter back to KMOX. Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm good, Paul. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. The book looks at the 2004-2005 television season, and you devote quite a few pages to the number one show on television, American Idol. So that's where I want to start with you here today.
Sure.
Is it true that American Idol is only on the air because Rupert Murdoch shoved it down the throats of the Fox executives who had rejected it?
That is exactly true. Now, to be fair to the Fox executives, they were only the last in the line because every other network had already rejected it. But when Fox got a hold of it, their only interest was to try to get something on in the summer, and they had nothing going in the summer, and they told the British executives in charge of American Idol that they would put it on only for free. In other words, if Fox would not spend a nickel on it, if the Idol producers could find sponsors for it, they would put it on. And they were in this state of, you know, no movement for some matter of months, and really it was right up against the deadline that Fox had given to the Idol producers that find sponsors, or I think they were within a day of killing the idea entirely, when Rupert Murdoch, who owns Fox, of course, got a phone call from his daughter, who lives in England and had been watching how great the show was doing in England, and told him, wow, this show is fantastic. And he, reacting to that, the next day called his people at Fox and said, what do you know about this Idol show? And they said, well, you know, we're thinking about doing this, and he just said, look, you know, stop thinking about doing it, go out and buy it. And if he hadn't done that, it would have probably passed out of Fox hands within a day and, you know, maybe not have gotten on American television at least for another year and maybe would have wound up at another network. I still think it would have gotten on TV eventually because it was so big in England, but it almost didn't arrive at Fox, where it has literally transformed that network.
Yes, it has, and we'll get to that transformation in a moment. But when you say it passed through the hands of all the other networks, How they let it slip through? Why wasn't there somebody smart enough there to go, hey, well, this is a hit, let's do something with it?
Well, you know, nobody in television is all that smart that they can see the future clearly. And here you have these two British record industry executives arriving in America and saying, oh, we've got this great idea for a reality music show. And every network is thinking to themselves, didn't ABC try that? Didn't they have a show called Making the Band about trying to form a boy band? That didn't do anything. And in the usual manner of network television, that means no show will ever work in that genre, at least to them. So they were rejected out of hand. In fact, Simon Cowell, who was presenting the show at that point, was just literally thrown out of several offices. He had some of the worst meetings of his life. People didn't know who he was. He was insulted. He was basically treated the way he treats people. and they threw him out. And after that, he went around back to England and sold the show in England. And when they came back, there was still so little interest in it that these guys were all but offering, you know, the show to cut it in half, would run a shorter amount of time. So it really was up to any network to step up and say, minimally, okay, we'll give it a chance, and none of them would do it.
Was the woman at ABC who turned it down not once but twice fired?
No, and it's very interesting. Her name is Andrea Wong, and Andrea has turned out to be this year's genius because she's the only network executive who took a risk on another British show called Dancing with the Stars. And she put that on last summer. Everyone said she's crazy, no one will watch Dancing, and it was a big hit. I think Andrea learned her lesson from American Idol, which I understand why she was resistant, because it had failed at ABC. The similar music reality show had failed. But Andrea actually saw the pilot, or more than the pilot, a bunch of episodes of the British show, and turned it down a second time, and I'm sure she's kicked herself ever since. But she's done a great job for ABC ever since then.
You know, you would have thought, going all the way back to All in the Family in the early 70s, another show that we imported from England, that the networks would have one or two people in London who they called every day saying, what's the hot show right now?
Well, it's a very good point. I mean, beyond that, let's face it, they other British shows had worked. Big Brother had worked in England, and Survivor was a British invention. By a British producer. And, you know, it's obvious that there are similarities in tastes around the world, because shows like CSI, for example, that we develop here, they wind up being hits everywhere. Lost is a hit everywhere. So tastes are similar. So I think it is worth looking at shows that work in other countries and saying, you know, maybe we should try that here.
Now, you also write in the book that even though they were smart enough to do what Rupert Murdoch told them to do and put the show on the air, they were not smart enough to sign a long-term deal with Simon Cowell.
No, that was interesting, too. They decided to bring Cowell over because they thought, you know, they needed an acerbic host.
Did they not realize that this guy was going to be the linchpin?
Not at all, because who was he? He wasn't a star. He was like a nobody. And they still didn't think the format was going to work. Okay, Rupert told them to put it on. Now they're going to put it on. They put it on. They used the same exact format as the British show. Now they bring in this guy, and they say, well, what's he going to do on this show? He's just going to sit there and say whether the people are good or bad. What are we going to pay him? So they paid him like $25,000 total for the first season, which is, you know, like tip money for these guys. So he doesn't have a contract. They don't have an option on him. Now the show is a raging, gigantic hit. It's all he has all the power. He literally, his agent was like sitting with like you know those cartoons with a guy having a knife and a fork and a napkin in his hand. He was ready to carve them up, and he did. I mean, he got the biggest salary of anybody on Fox in history.
And does the network leave Simon alone now?
Oh, they leave him alone. In fact, one of the other funny things that happened was after he was on the show, did a few of the episodes, and was, you know, obviously nasty to all these would-be singers. The American producers came up to him and had a script telling him, oh, here's some more put-downs for you. And Simon said, well, what is this? Well, you're scripted, aren't you? No, this is my real opinion. I don't write my answers down ahead of the time. This is what I really think. And they really basically leave him alone now because he's obviously the key to that show's success. And they have really, he has all the power in that relationship now.
But the question now is, can Simon expand his brand? He's tried with this American Inventor show on Thursday nights on IBC.
Yeah.
How's that doing?
It started out absolutely great. And the reason it started out great was that the initial part of it was like Idol, because you got a bunch of very goofy people with really funny and strange inventions. And that was fun, and people enjoyed it. The problem with the Inventor format, and I thought it would be from the beginning, is when you get down to the final 12, there's no way to vary what they're doing. They only have one invention in them. They don't have like six or seven that they can vary.
Right.
So it's the same thing every week, and the ratings have greatly diminished. Now, Simon has another show coming up this summer on NBC called America's Got Talent, and I think that'll work better. That's a talent show for people who are, you know, have weird, strange talents beyond singing, like spinning plates or talking parakeets. And the idea there is, the winner will wind up with an act in Vegas. And the show had to be passed by Fox. Fox has a first-look deal on anything Simon does. So they passed on their show, and now they really regret it. They're really afraid that NBC is going to have a hit with it.
How many times do these guys have to learn the Simon Cowell lesson? Well, I mean, it's better to go with him and fail than to not go with him and have and then later go, whoops!
Yes, exactly. It is a big risk now to pass on one of his products. But you know, the Inventor show looks like it won't make it, so they may say to themselves, well, we're glad we didn't go for that one. And Fox did pick up a different show from him called Duets, which would be an amateur singing with a professional. So I think they may feel like they have enough talent competition on their air. They don't want to dilute the popularity of Idol. That's the last thing they want. They want Idol to stay huge, so they don't want to have too many similar shows on their own air.
Is that also the reason Idol is only on once a year?
Well, the real reason it's only on once a year, Fox says that, and they make a boast about it. We're not like NBC with The Apprentice, where we put it on too much. We realize you put it on once a year. Well, that's baloney. The fact is the producers have retained control of the show. They won't let them put it on twice a year. Early on, when Fox had nothing working but Idol, they would have put it on 52 weeks a year if they could have, but they didn't own the show. The producers own the show, and Simon Cowell has made his own spin-off in England called The X Factor, and that plays in the fall in England, so he wouldn't even be available. So there's no way it could be on anything but once a year.
Gotcha. Could House be a hit without Idol?
Well, it's a really good show. I don't know if it could have been launched like this without Idol, and that really is the advantage of having a monster juggernaut like this, that you can sort of direct viewers into a very worthy show. It wasn't doing very well until Idol came on, and then it was fed the big Idol audience, and it took off. It's a very good show, though.
Now, let me talk about another hit show. We're talking with Bill Carter. His new book is called Desperate Networks. Let's talk about the Sunday night ABC shows Desperate Housewives and Grey's Anatomy, which this fall are going to be up against football. ABC used to have Monday Night Football. Now NBC is taking over the franchise and calling it Sunday Night Football because it'll be on that night, and Monday Night Football will be on ESPN. Does ABC look at that and go, well, we have the perfect counter-programming here because these are more chick TV as opposed to guy TV, and we'll just keep Desperate Housewives and Grey's Anatomy on, and we'll really, really, really be able to split the viewership?
Well, yes and no. They do believe that they have the right counter-programming. That doesn't mean they're not going to take a hit when football goes on, because football does attract, A, some women, and, B, there are men watching those shows as well.
Yep.
Now, they already, I believe, have decided they have to split those two shows up because they need to launch other shows with those hits. And Grey's Anatomy sitting at 10 o'clock on Sunday night is doing great for them, but it's not helping them build another hit. So I think they're more likely to move Grey's Anatomy to Monday night at 9 o'clock. And
8 o'clock Central.
8 o'clock Central, that's right, replacing where their own football franchise was. And that also, by the way, is good counter-programming to Monday Night Football on ESPN. And then they'll put another show at 9 o'clock Central after that, and they'll have the same situation on Sunday night, where they'll create an opening after Desperate Housewives to put a new show in there. But there's huge pressure on them to deliver, because if they put shows after those two that don't make it, then they've broken up their Sunday night lineup that's a powerhouse.
Yeah.
At the same time football is going in. And it could weaken their overall performance. Interestingly, this year, after coming off the fabulous year where they had three enormous hits in one season, they added absolutely no scripted shows at all that were successful at all. And I think the pressure is really on ABC because, you know, one of the more amazing things that happened was that the executives responsible for all three of those shows were fired before they got on the air. So the new regime that followed them and reaped the benefits of those programs has not really capitalized.
Wait a minute. The executives who were responsible for ABC's biggest hits were fired?
They were fired before the shows went on. What happened was they developed the shows, they purchased them, they put them into pilot production, but the management, the Disney management, decided this leadership was not good and ABC had struggled for years, and they didn't believe these shows would be any better than the ones they'd put on before. So that was April, and they fired them in April. The shows were announced in May. By the time they got on the air in September, they were hits, and these two executives who put them on were long gone.
Oh, and the people who fired them still have their jobs.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. And the programs they've put on since have not measured up at all.
Of course not. Oh.
That was another unusual circumstance.
Did Desperate Housewives also have to go through the same thing that Idol went through, get pitched to all the networks before it finally got picked up?
Absolutely. In fact, what happened with that was you had a creator named Mark Cherry who had not worked in 7 years. He was really down on his luck. He couldn't get a job as a staff writer. I mean, he had been the lead writer and showrunner on Golden Girls, a comedy, but he hadn't had really serious work in 7 years. So he sat down and wrote what he thought would be a great script, a spec script. In other words, people could read the whole script and decide whether they liked it or not. And he really threw himself into this, and he was convinced it was the best thing he ever wrote. But his reputation had, you know, been so tarnished, he couldn't get anyone to take him seriously. So every network was offered it. Every network read the show when it was, you know, initially in its first process. And then he brought in other people, other agents. He brought in another writer to help him make it more of a soap opera. And it went around through another cycle and really only got on the air because finally a network executive at ABC took it home one night thinking it was at least a great title. He didn't think much of the show, and he didn't expect much from Mark Cherry. But he took it home. He read it, and it knocked his eyes out. He just thought it was a great, great script, and he stood up for it. And I think one of the things the book points out is that a lot of these shows that fall out of the sky, they need somebody to champion them. They have to step up and say, this is great. Yes, the writer isn't well-known, and yes, it isn't like anything else we have on the air, but it's great. We got to take a chance on it. And finally, Mark Cherry got somebody to take a chance on him, and of course, it was a hit from the first night it was on.
Yeah. One of the other great stories you tell about Desperate Housewives in the book is about Nicolette Sheridan's audition.
She was deluded into thinking she should audition for the part of Bree, which is this ice queen, you know, red-haired ice queen character, really based on Mark Cherry's mother, by the way. And that's not what Nicolette Sheridan is obviously known for. And she came in and just gave an audition that Cherry found appallingly bad. But But at the end of it, the director went up and started talking to her, and Jerry couldn't believe it. He thought they should just throw her out. But he thought, you know, there's this other part, the kind of, you know, slutty housewife. And Nicola Sheridan basically said, oh, you want me to try out for a slut? That I can do. And she could. She got that part.
A phrase, by the way, that has been said many, many times in Hollywood.
I think so.
Yeah. The book is called...
Maybe not even during auditions.
The casting couch or The Office, who knows? Desperate Networks is the brand new book from Bill Carter, the author of The Late Shift and the television writer for The New York Times. We're back to talk more in just a moment on The Paul Harris Show. You're on News Talk 1120 KMOX. The featured book on my website, harrisonline.com, is the brand new one from Bill Carter. It's called Desperate Networks. Bill is the guy who in the 90s wrote the definitive book about Jay Leno and David Letterman going after Johnny Carson's desk and chair to host The Tonight Show. It was called The Late Shift, a great book, turned into a terrific TV movie on HBO. And did it absolutely destroy your relationships with the Leno and Letterman camps, Bill?
No, not at all, at least not initially. I mean, for some time after that, I talked to both guys a lot. Now, Dave doesn't talk to anybody anymore. And Jay has kind of clammed up with the press in recent years. But it did not damage my relationship about them.
You write in the book Desperate Networks about Conan O'Brien taking over and how NBC had to kind of manipulate Jay Leno into giving up the desk that he had gotten from Johnny Carson in a kind of, I don't want to say underhanded way, but certainly an intriguing way, as you wrote in the first book. But in this way, what happened this time around?
Well, it really wasn't underhanded. I guess they found themselves in a terrible bind. Conan O'Brien literally has done that show longer than Letterman did now. He's been on the air longer than Letterman had the 12:30 show. So clearly he wanted to move up and do something in his career that was different and get into the 11:30 time slot just the way Letterman did. And, you know, the only place to go is the Tonight Show on NBC. There's really nowhere else they could put him. So unless they found a way to get Jay to give up the show, they knew that Conan was going to leave and probably go to ABC, where he would start up another late-night show at 11:30, replacing Nightline, and then you'd have three hosts going head-to-head, all of whom were developed by NBC. And clearly the Tonight Show, even if it continued to still win, would be diminished in some way if Conan took a lot of the young male viewers that like his show over to ABC. And NBC also didn't know what that meant for the distant future when Jay would eventually give the show up. So they had to just, the only thing they could do is somehow guarantee the show to Conan when Jay would step down. And if Conan's representatives, who are really tough Hollywood agents, had to be assured that this would happen by contract. So they discussed this with Jay, and the only thing they could tell Jay was the obvious, which is that if they didn't let Conan know he could get the Tonight Show, he was going to leave and go to another network, and the exact same scenario that played out the last time would play again, where the Tonight Show being owned by Jay meant another late-night host of NBC had to go and leave the network. And Jay remembered how badly that had affected him the first time. He got a lot of bad press, which he isn't used to. People thought he had somehow mistreated David Letterman, which he really didn't do. I mean, he wanted the show as much as Dave did, but, you know, there was a body of people who thought Dave deserved it, and he would be again criticized, I think, and he understood that, and it played on him. I mean, NBC basically brought it up sort of indirectly, you know, we'll have the same situation again, and I don't think Jay wanted that to happen. So he acquiesced, and he agreed to give up the show in 2009. Now, the problem with that is it creates sort of a lame duck situation, which is odd, for one thing, but also Jay is showing no signs of losing the leadership at 11:30. So when the year comes around, 2009, he may still be dominating that time period, and there'll be no reason for him to go other than this contract. And I wouldn't be surprised to see Jay leave and go to another network at that time. And NBC will have the same problem it had, only with an even more popular host. So it could set up a very interesting scenario at that point.
In the meantime, NBC also has to figure out what they get to replace Conan O'Brien. Is there anybody in the chute?
I don't think there is yet, and they're not thinking about it yet. They got 3 years to go with that, and I think they'll look for a young, 30-ish performer who can, you know, sort of do the same thing Conan did, which, let's face it, Conan didn't start out gangbusters. He had to work his way into that job.
Yep.
And And I don't think they think that is nearly as big a priority for them as the Tonight Show.
What do you think is the future for David Letterman? I once asked our mutual friend Aaron Barnhart, who will be on here again later on this afternoon, as he is every Monday, I asked him if he ever thought that David Letterman would break the Johnny Carson 30-year record.
Yeah.
He said that Letterman has so much respect for Carson that he probably wouldn't, just out of respect. What do you think?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, but, you know, if you think about it, Dave has now been on CBS since 1993, okay? That's 13 years. He was on NBC for 11. Do they count? That, you know, if they count, that's 24 years now.
Yep.
That would leave six more to go. I think that would be about the time when Dave would step down. So just by logic, when he gets to that age, he might say, oh, I'm 60. He would be about 65, 64, 65 at that point. He might step down. I think there's been rumors about him stepping down earlier than that. But now that Jay has announced he's leaving, I think Dave will certainly stay at least that long to see what happens when Conan comes into the time period. One thing about Dave is his life is pretty much about that show. You know, he's not really doing much else. In fact, he really doesn't do any other show business work at all, whereas Jay makes a million appearances all around the country for, you know, stand-up comedy. Dave doesn't do that. The show is his life. So I don't think he wants to walk away from it yet.
Did Carson ever warm to Leno and to Conan?
Yes, to Conan. In fact, I wrote in the book, when he found out that Conan was going to get the Tonight Show, he spontaneously got on the phone and called him and wished him well and gave him some advice, you know, advised him about how to handle everything. And I think he did a nice little gesture there for Conan. And Conan, of course, was quite moved by it. And Johnny only died about a month after that. But there was never really a relationship with Carson and Leno. Carson really did feel like Leno's manager had tried to cut the ground out from him back when he was in his last years at the Tonight Show.
Yeah, thank you, Helen Kushnick.
Yeah.
The book is called Desperate Networks. Bill Carter, the writer for the New York Times and the author of The Late Shift in the 90s, now is back with this great new book called Desperate Networks, and we'll talk more about it when we come back in a moment here on The Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Talking with Bill Carter, television writer for the New York Times, has a great new book out called Desperate Networks. It is basically, the premise here is that he looked at the entire 2004-2005 television season, not the one we're in now, but last year's, and used it as the basis for writing about all sorts of related issues. And Bill, that was the year Lost came on the air on ABC and became such a big hit, although as a fan of the show, I'm still waiting to have one thing answered. Not one thing in particular, just anything.
Yeah.
You know, question after question after question, please give me an answer. So you tell me, how did that show get on the air?
Well, that was an amazing story. I mean, you know, one of the fired ABC executives was on a beach in Hawaii with his family, and he had seen the movie Castaway with Tom Hanks, and he thought to himself, wow, what if there was like a whole group of people who landed on an island from a plane crash? I wonder if we could do a show that was like a fictionalized version of Survivor. And he just had that idea, and boy, he was like a dog with a bone. He would not let up, even though it went through so many hurdles, had to cross so many hurdles. I mean, a lot of people thought initially that it was, you know, kind of like Gilligan's Island or something, and the original script that was written really wasn't very good. And then he brought in J.J. Abrams, this terrific young writer-director who just directed the Tom Cruise Mission Impossible movie, very talented guy, and boy, he came up with the idea of making the island sort of a menace, and that just changed it tremendously. But it also became a very expensive pilot to do the plane crash and all the special effects and all the many, many, many characters that they wanted to bring into the show. And this ABC executive, Lloyd Braun, stuck with it and really kept advancing them the money and kept saying, no, we got to keep going, even though the Disney management was saying this is an outrageous amount of money to spend on a pilot, and you know, we don't think it'll even work as a series. Who's going to watch this? And it really cost Braun his job. I mean, he basically went all the way with that. And even after he left, he heard a word from inside ABC that they didn't like the pilot, that they thought it was too expensive, that it could maybe play as a miniseries. And he actually did something extraordinary. After he was fired, he called NBC and contacted NBC and tried to sell them the show. He didn't even have the rights to the show, and he tried to sell them the pilot. He snuck the pilot to them, hoping that NBC would be interested, because he just wanted this to get on the air. He thought it was, it was like his baby. You know, he wanted to see it get on the air. And ABC finally did test the show, and it tested brilliantly. And they reluctantly said, I guess we got to put it on. And, you know, they put it on, and smartly they did promote it very, very well and put a lot of money into it. And, boy, it opened up huge. And I'll tell you, I never missed that show, Paul. And it just keeps doing more interesting things and keeping me hooked. And I still don't know what's going on exactly, but every week I watch, so I think they're doing a good job.
Yep, I watch it just because every week I figure this has got to be the week I get something figured out. Was that pilot that Lloyd Braun was pitching around, was that the same pilot that we saw as the first episode of the show?
Absolutely, yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. A sensational pilot, by the way.
Remarkable. Yep. Remarkable. Do the guys who run these networks, the Jeff Zuckers and my ultimate boss, Les Moonves, are they really personally competitive with each other?
Oh, yes. Well, especially when Jeff was literally the top programmer, and Les has always been the top programmer at CBS, no matter what job he has. He continues to be the top programmer. So, and they both are the kind of guy who likes to see their name in the paper, so they would always be in the press. And for years, Les wanted to overtake NBC, and Jeff, even though they weren't adding many hit shows, he was manipulating the schedule brilliantly and keeping them just a little bit ahead of Moonves. And so whenever they'd be, like, in public, Les would take shots at Jeff. And sometimes in private, he took some really nasty shots at him. But it was really a matter of being, you know, the two most recognized guys in those jobs at a hyper-competitive level. And obviously, you look to your competitors, see what he's doing, and you comment on that.
Yeah, particularly when you're Les Moonves and you're in first place, and you're Jeff Zucker and you're in fourth place now. I guess Zucker has to be the more adventurous one now. The whoever's in last place always has to be more adventurous to try to get back up there, don't they?
That's sort of the reason why these things go in cycles, although NBC looked like they were not going to have that happen to them because they stayed on top for 10, 12 years in a row. But when you are successful, you start to say to yourself, well, this is what we do, this kind of show, and you kind of try to duplicate that instead of saying, well, you know, this one broke through because it was fresh and different. We got to zag here. We can't just do the same thing over and over again. So you get a little complacent, and you try to produce another Friends instead of producing something interesting like Lost, and eventually that catches up to you, and eventually did catch up to NBC, and now that they're in fourth place, they're looking at the landscape and saying, give us anything. Show us something new. And yes, they will take more risks because of that. And they'll probably keep shows on the air longer. One of the things people complain about is that shows get yanked off too soon. And successful networks tend to do that faster than unsuccessful networks. Because if an unsuccessful network puts on a show that at least is getting some buzz, some people are talking about it, there's a little press about it, they got very little to lose by keeping it on. And a lot of those shows eventually click, like Seinfeld did, obviously. And you know, so it's worth trying when you're failing to just stick with something for a longer time. Whereas a successful network says, you know, I can do better. I have to do better.
But you still don't think that Heather Graham show would have gotten a second episode on any other network, do you?
I doubt it. You know, the remarkable thing about that was they poured money into promoting it. It was on billboards everywhere, and clearly spent a lot of money, even though, according to ABC people, they had seen future episodes and thought, boy, this isn't going to work very well. I guess they still hoped because she was a star it would open and they'd get away with it. But when it didn't open, they thought, well, now there's no reason to keep it on.
I don't think that show was even to the end of the half hour before somebody said, get this off!
I don't know if that happened, but I know there was a show once going way back in time on CBS that was an hour-long show that was canceled after the half hour point.
Now, why do the networks, you talk about familiarity, why do they seem to have literally identical shows? Like, I know there's two shows competing to get on this fall, one by Aaron Sorkin and one by Tina Fey, which are both kind of behind the scenes at Saturday Night Live kind of shows.
Well, that's remarkable because they're both on the same network.
Oh, they are?
They're both on NBC. That's the most amazing part about that one, that NBC bought two of them, a comedy and a drama. And clearly what happened there was Sorkin is a big-name talent, obviously, and this was his first show after West Wing. How are they not going to buy it, right? They got to take a chance on that. And now at the same time, Tina Fey was a key writer for them on Saturday Night Live and a talent they want to keep. She comes up with a comedy show. They have to buy that. Both pilots, I hear, are very good. and NBC needs good products, so I think they're probably both going to get on the air in the fall.
How bizarre. The book is called Desperate Networks. We've only touched the surface of what he gets into here. Great stuff, inside stuff from a guy who's been writing about television for 30 years, writes about it full-time for the New York Times, and in this book, Desperate Networks, you'll get an insight into the industry that very few others have. Bill Carter, thanks for your time today.
Great to be with you.
It's the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.